In some ways, the passage that we read earlier from Mark chapter 15 is one of the saddest in the Bible. Here is the Lord Jesus Christ, the Son of God, the promised one of Israel, the one whom God for hundreds of years previously had been saying, one day he'll come, and he'll come and he'll save his people from their sins. And the whole of the people of Israel, or many of the people of Israel, were eagerly expecting this Messiah, the Christ, to come. And he came. He was born of a virgin all those years before. And he grew as from a baby into a child and into a man. He started his ministry and for 3 years had gone around Galilee and into Jerusalem and to one or two other places and had told people about the good news. Who had gone around, Mark told us in chapter 1, doing good. He'd performed miracles. He'd healed the sick. He'd even raised the dead. But for some reason, there were many who opposed him. And in Mark chapter 15, these various people who opposed Jesus somehow come together. And it seems as though in all the different folk who are here, that the priests, the Pontius Pilate, the ruler, the crowd who are there, the soldiers, it just needs one, it just needs somebody to intervene and to put a stop to all this. How can the righteous one, how can the one who's so popular, how can the one who's done so much for so many, how can he be tried in this way? How can he be condemned in this way? Surely there's somebody who will just take a stand. Surely there's somebody who will be on his side. But no one is found. And even in chapter 14, all of his friends, his closest friends, those who'd been with him for so long, those who'd ate bread at his table, those who'd shared his life, those who had so much to thank him for, those who'd seen him not just perform the miracles to the crowds, but heard him pray on his own, they'd all gone. They'd all deserted him. And one of those who was most close, one of those who was his perhaps most fervent supporter, Peter, has denied he even knew him. So maybe the events of chapter 15 are just inevitable. If those who are closest have gone away and even denied him, what hope does Jesus have from the priests and the ruler and the crowd and the soldiers? You see, as we go through these verses together, we'll see these various people and the part that they have to play in the death and the crucifixion of the Lord Jesus Christ. And the first thing that we see as we go through these verses is the priests who refuse to recognize the Messiah. We see the priests who refuse to recognize the Messiah. As we get into chapter 15 and verse 1, Mark has one of his favorite words. Immediately, in the morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council, the Jewish ruling council, that is, called the Sanhedrin. And they bound Jesus, led him away, and delivered him to Pilate. Do you remember that in chapter 14, literally overnight, Jesus was arrested in the middle of the night there in the Garden of Gethsemane. He was taken away, and this trial was quickly arranged and took place. The high priest was there and others as well. And it seems that almost as the trial was taking place, the word was going out from the chief priests and those around him, sending for the other members of the council. And you can imagine people knocking on the door, people being woken from their sleep. You've got to get down to the council. There's an emergency meeting. It's happening tonight. You must be there. There's a vital vote to take place. And over the night, these men come from all over the city, come to hear. And by the time that perhaps some of them arrive, the verdict's already been made. They found him guilty. That was in chapter 14. But now they need to decide what to do. You see, they found him guilty, but they found him guilty of great blasphemy. They found him guilty of a religious crime. But these priests, the members of the Sanhedrin, the Jewish council, they're not able to prosecute against him in this way. They're not able to do what they really want to do legally. They want to see Jesus dead. But they don't have the authority for that because the Romans rule over Israel in this day. So what do they do? How are they going to respond? Well, that's what they need to make this consultation with in the morning with the elders and the scribes and the whole council. They decide what they're going to do is they lead him away and they deliver him to Pilate. We'll see a bit more of Pilate later, but he's the Roman official in charge of the province. And they have this charge against Jesus. They're clever, you see. What they're concerned about with Jesus is his blasphemy. That he claims to be the Son of God, that the promised one. That's their charge against him. But they tweak it slightly. You see in chapter 14 and verse 61, you'll see that their charge against him, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? Jesus said, I am. Verse 63, what further need do we have of witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. That's what they've got against him. He claimed to be the promised one of God. But Pilate doesn't care about these minor arguments of religion as he would see it. So they reformulate the religious charge against Jesus into a political one. And by the time they get to Pilate in chapter 15 and verse 2, the charge is not, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? The charge is, are you the King of the Jews? You see, because Jesus was the Christ, the Jews knew that made him their king. And they knew that if they told Pilate, here's somebody who sets themselves up as the King of the Jews, here's someone who's usurping your authority and usurping Rome's authority, they knew that Pilate would be very interested in that. And that's the charge that they bring against Jesus. But you see, these priests, it's a terrible thing that we read of them because they are guilty of the blood of the Lord Jesus Christ. They are utterly without excuse. You see, as they've had Jesus there in this trial overnight, they've, as it were, been examining the evidence against him or for him. They've heard him say from his own lips that he is the Christ, the Son of the Blessed. They've heard his claims. They've been following him around Jerusalem and all over the country for the 3 years previous. They've seen the things that he's done. They've witnessed his miracles. They've challenged him to debate and to understanding of the Old Testament. They've had opportunity to hear his preaching and to witness his miracles. They've seen him raise Lazarus from the dead. They've seen all this. And then they've heard the claim that he's the Christ, the Son of the Blessed. And what do? They reject him. They refuse to recognize him. Not only so, it's not only that they've heard his own testimony. It's not only that they've heard the testimony of Lazarus and others that have been involved and seen the miracles and had miracles performed on them. Not only that, but they've got their Bibles too. And these men knew their Bibles perhaps better than anybody else. That's what their job was to do, particularly the scribes who are mentioned there in chapter 15 and verse 1, but the chief priests and the elders certainly too. They knew their Bibles very well. They knew what the Old Testament said. They knew those promises of God. We'll see some of them later on. They knew about the one who would come. Well, they should have known. They had no excuse. They were so religious. They had so much knowledge. They'd heard all about Jesus. They'd even heard his testimony. And yet still they refused to recognize the Messiah. Why? How could this be? Well, chapter 15 and verse 10 gives us exactly the answer to that question. For Pilate knew that the chief priests had handed him over because of envy. You see, these men were not interested in whether Jesus' claims were true. These men assumed that Jesus' claims were false because they didn't want to submit to him. They didn't want to admit that perhaps he was the one that he claimed to be. They couldn't take his claims seriously because they knew the consequences of doing so. They knew that if he really was the Messiah, if he really was the promised one, then it wouldn't be they who ruled the religious activities in Israel. It would be him. and they were jealous of his popularity, and they were jealous of those who followed him. And because of envy, because of fear, they rejected him. They refused to recognize the Messiah. The tragedy, of course, is that today there are many chief priests and many elders and many scribes. And I know many of them, I'm sure you do too. Not literally, of course. I know one or two priests, but no chief priests. I don't know any scribes. I won't mention the elders. But I know folk who are just like them, you see. I know folk who may be a little bit like James testified earlier on, who have grown up and heard lots of stories about Jesus. They know many things about him. But they've never really got to grips with his claims. They've never really recognized him as the Messiah, as the Lord of all. They've got their Bibles in front of them, and they maybe got a Bible on their shelf, perhaps even on their bedside table. They hear the Bible preached in church, and they sing through the songs, many of the ones that we've been singing today, perhaps. And there's no excuse. But they refuse to recognize the Messiah because they know that if they understand and realize that Jesus is Lord, then they'll have to bow the knee. And again, as James reminded us, there'll be things that have to go, and priorities will have to change, and our world will be turned upside down. And because they're happy with the status quo, and they don't want to change, they refuse to recognize who Jesus is. It's a tragedy repeated hundreds, if not thousands of times, even in this our town. The priests who refuse to recognize the Messiah. We can move on in the passage and we can see, secondly, not merely priests who refuse to recognize the Messiah, but the ruler who refuses to take responsibility. The ruler who refuses to take responsibility. I'm talking, of course, of Pontius Pilate, and in many ways this is what this section is about. It's about Pontius Pilate and how he responds to all that is going on around him. He was a Roman prefect. He was a puppet ruler, really, under Rome, and he really had to do what Rome said. And his job was to give the Jews a modicum of freedom, sufficient freedom so that they didn't rebel, but not so much freedom that they actually were allowed to do what they wanted. That was Pilate's job. And he was the longest serving of all those who were governors, prefects over Judea. He didn't really, though, have very much power. He had lots of prestige, but little power. He even had very little in the way of staff. He had a few soldiers dotted about the country, but even then they were Roman soldiers who were accountable often to Rome rather than to him. So the way in which power was delegated, the way in which the province was run, was through the delegation of power to local council of magistrates. And Pontius Pilate, you see, was reliant on these people to keep peace on the local level. And if they did their job properly, if he could keep them sweet, then he could sit back in his palace with his feet up and enjoy the privileges of being a rich Roman ruler, and they could get on with the real work of running the nation. And of course, those whom he delegated to, they enjoyed it. They enjoyed the power and the privilege, even though they were puppets really under him. But that's how it worked. And law and order was often kept then, as I guess it would have been in this nation many centuries ago, through these local magistrates, these local leaders. Men like the chief priests and the elders and the scribes. And you see, because the chief priests and the elders of the scribe could not give this death sentence that they wanted for Jesus, as we saw earlier, they brought, as it were, a private prosecution, you might say, against Jesus Christ. And they brought him to Pontius Pilate. And they needed, they wanted, they pleaded for Pilate to condemn Jesus, as they already had. Now, of course, perhaps you know already that in the Roman system there were complicated rules of justice, and in many ways the nation was one that enjoyed these rules and liked to have the right way of doing things. But in Judea, in Jesus' day, those rules only applied to Roman citizens. You remember in the book of Acts that the Apostle Paul once was arrested and beaten. And it was only when they found out that he was a Roman citizen that they apologized for all that they'd done, and they realized what a mess this could be, because Paul would be able to appeal and to condemn them for daring to do this to a Roman citizen. But Jesus, of course, has no such privileges. He's not a Roman citizen. And all these protections that are in law for the Romans don't apply to Jesus. And Pontius Pilate has the right, literally, to do as he wished in the application of the law to non-Roman citizens. He could do what he liked. It was entirely in his hands. Jesus was at his mercy. Now, what do we know about Pontius Pilate from the history books? Well, if we look at the historians of the day, the first century historians, people who were Jews and historians who weren't Christians, Josephus and Philo, the most well-known of these historians, first century historians, complain against Pilate's judgment in so many things. He seemed to often antagonize the Jews through thoughtlessness. And then he could be very intractable. He wouldn't back down. He could often just aggravate the situation. And eventually he was removed from power by Rome for exactly that reason. He was aggravating the Jews rather than appeasing them, as was his job. So he was a man that was maybe difficult to deal with. But as Jesus comes to him, Pilate knows the truth about Jesus, doesn't he? Look at verse 10. We've looked at it already. He knows that the chief priests have come with a trumped-up charge, that they've handed him over just because of envy. And verse 14, he knows that Jesus is innocent. Why? What evil has he done? He asks. I've got no charge to bring against him, really. What's he done? But you see, the trial, the way that trials worked in these days is that they were open and public. And it's not like it is today, where if you're in the public gallery in a court of law and you say something, you'll be thrown out. How dare you bring contempt to the court by speaking when it's not your turn? It was certainly not like that in Jesus' day. But these trials would be open and public. And those people who were interested in such things would all come along, and they'd be literally cheering from the sides and shouting accusations or defense against their chosen person, either the prosecutor or the one who was accused. And that's what happened here. And as the crowd cry out against Jesus, Pilate, verse 15, wants to gratify the crowd. He gives in to the pressure from outside. You see, there are many people who've got a certain sympathy towards Pontius Pilate. He's even been made a saint in some churches in Ethiopia and Egypt. But Mark does not think that Pontius Pilate is a saint. Mark is very clear. Mark knows that he is a crowd pleaser. Mark knows and shows us that he's someone who fears man rather than God. He's someone who refuses to take responsibility. He constantly asks questions. Did you notice that as we go on? Verse 9, do you want me to release to you? Verse 12, what do you want me to do? Verse 14, what evil has he done? He's the man who's in charge. He's the man with the power. He's the man who has Jesus at his mercy. But he won't make a decision. He won't show his cards. He just keeps asking questions. He's trying to push out the blame to others. He's not willing to answer the questions. But despite that, the way that Mark tells us his story, Pilate is still guilty for the death of Jesus. You see, it seems that Pilate had some sympathy towards Jesus even. He wanted Jesus to be set free. He wanted Barabbas to be killed. He had sympathy for Jesus, but he wasn't prepared to act. He sees little harm in letting Jesus die. He sees little harm in that. And he sees little value in letting Jesus live. He views Jesus as the King of the Jews. Well, it's all right for the Jews, but he's no king of mine. it's all right for them, it's not for me. He sees little of value in Jesus Christ. And so he refuses to take responsibility, and yet he is still guilty. And just as I know many priests, I know many Pontius Pilates as well. I know many people who know a little bit about Jesus as Pontius Pilate did. I know many people who've seen a little glimpses of Jesus' life, and they've come to the conclusion, well, here's a good man. Here's somebody who I can admire and even respect. But at the same time, they see little value in him. Oh, he's good for other people. Oh, I can see how you like Jesus. I can see how Jesus is good for you, but not for me. There's no value for me. I'm not going to go out on a limb for Jesus. I can't see how that would benefit me. Or I'll admire him from a distance. But when the rubber hits the road, when things get tough, I'm going to stand back. And I'll let history take its course. And I'll wave things on by. I'll go with the flow. But I'm not going to take a stand for this man. And I know many people like that. Maybe you do too. I know many Pontius Pilates. But you see, folk who admire Jesus from a distance but won't stand for him and with him. Folk who are happy to see Jesus as being useful for others but see no relevance of him to their own souls. Just like Pilate, are guilty of the death of Jesus. I know many Pontius Pilates. Well, we know the priests who refuse to recognize the Messiah, the ruler who refuses to take responsibility. Thirdly, the crowd who refuses to release the innocent. The crowd who refuse to release the innocent. You see, in the middle of this story, as Pilate is there facing Jesus and trying to work out what he can do with this man, he comes up with an idea, perhaps. And he remembers that he's got an opportunity to get rid of the problem. Because verse 6 tells us that he was accustomed to releasing one prisoner to them, whoever they requested. And Pontius Pilate has a cunning plan. Pontius Pilate thinks, well, if the crowd cry for the release of Jesus, then I can say to the chief priest, well, it's not my fault that he's been released. It's the crowd. Blame them. And Pontius Pilate may well have known of the high regard that the crowd had for Jesus. And Pontius Pilate might well have thought, this is a way of getting rid of the problem. I can put the blame on the crowd. So I can say to the Jewish chief priest, I'd have loved to have helped you, but I couldn't do anything this time. It's not my fault. It was the crowd. It seems that that's what Pontius Pilate tried to do. But there's a problem. There's a problem. Because the multitude crying aloud, verse 8, asks Pilate to do this. And the one who is against Jesus is going to be one or the other? Barabbas, who had committed murder in the rebellion. And Pontius Pilate maybe feels he's on a safe wicket here. Well, nothing, they're not going to choose a murderer over this good man. But that's exactly what they do. Verse 13, they cried out again, crucify him. Then Pilate said to them, why? What evil has he done? But they cried out all the more, crucify him. They refuse to release the innocents. Why would they do such a thing? Why would they choose a murderer over a good man? Well, the Bible doesn't give us an answer, but there are many possible reasons it's worth quickly exploring. It's possible, of course, that Barabbas, who had been a leader in this rebellion, verse 7, was perhaps admired by the crowd. It may be that the crowd saw Barabbas as something of a Robin Hood type figure, someone who would stand up for the working classes against the Roman imperial rule over them, someone who would stand up for Jews against those who sought to oppress them. And as he rose up in this rebellion, it may be that the crowd thought, well, here's someone who stands up for us. We've been following Jesus for all these years. We've been going round. We've been listening to him. But all he's done is, he's healed some people. But what's he ever done for us, this Jesus? Whereas at least this Barabbas had a go. At least this Barabbas took the fight to the Romans. At least this Barabbas got his sword out and was in some action. At least that. Maybe that's how they viewed Barabbas. maybe two, that at this trial, very early in the morning, attracted just the wrong sort of people from Jesus' point of view. You see, the city was full of pious Jews, but they were away at various places. They'd had the Passover feast. They had preparations to make and things to do, and they were concerned about all that, not concerned necessarily to come to a trial. You see, nobody knew that Jesus was there. All this had been done in secret at night, do you remember? That's what the Jews wanted, particularly the Jewish leaders. They arrested Jesus at night in secret in the garden. Nobody knew. It's not as though the disciples had been going round drumming up support. Not at all. They'd fled. They'd abandoned him. So Jesus' supporters, the pious people in Jerusalem, were probably very absent from this crowd. And instead, it was those who had come to witness the execution. Those who had come to see what would happen to Barabbas, maybe his supporters were there. But Jesus' were not. And nobody was willing to stand up for Jesus. And of course, the main reason why the crowd responded in the way, verse 11, tells us the chief priest stirred up the crowd so that he should rather release Barabbas to them. You see, the crowd refuse to release the innocent. They'll go along for the entertainment. They'll take all the excitement of a murderer, and they'll do away with a good man who taught, who healed, who fed the hungry. So often crowds do just that, don't they? One of the commentators on the passage says this: the crowd chooses the one who takes the life of others to achieve his own selfish ends, and condemns the one who gives his life for others in obedience to God. They want a bandit who will be comfortable with murder and mayhem, not one who refuses to resist evil with violence. It's a fatal preference, the commentator says. The violence of renegades like Barabbas continued to spiral until it eventually erupted in war against Rome. And the outcome was inevitable when that happened just a generation ahead of this. Rome destroyed Jerusalem, its temple, and most of the inhabitants in a brutal siege. The chief priests fear Jesus because he's a threat to the temple. Do you remember that from verse 14? In turn, they urge the release of the one whose violent ways will eventually rain down terror and destruction on the land. Do you see what the commentator is saying? That the chief priests are fearful of their own position, so they say to the crowd, let Barabbas go, let this rebel go, let him go, set him free, and condemn Jesus, because they think that Jesus will bring them down. And in so doing, that's one of the nails in their own coffin, as over the generations to come, rebels like Barabbas do finally take the fight to Rome. They rise up in rebellion against Rome. There's this great war. And it's the chief priests and the scribes and the elders who are on the losing side. And the temple is destroyed, the thing they feared the most. They indeed become responsible for. You see, as the crowd refuses to release the innocent man, they're hammering nails into their own coffin. They're doing the very opposite of what they intend. They perhaps chose Barabbas as a poke in the eye to Pilate. Perhaps they can see gain for themselves. Perhaps they found the violent more easy to understand than the peaceful. They just went along with what they were being encouraged to do. And again, I know many in the crowd. Perhaps most are in the crowd. Oh, there are some like the priests who know their Bibles well but refuse to recognize the Messiah. There are some like Pontius Pilate who admire Jesus from a distance but refuse to take a stand for him. But there are many in the crowd who are not prepared to investigate Jesus for themselves but will just do whatever they're stirred up to do, will just take on the spirit of the age. And they'll just go with the flow. And if the world tells them that science has disproved God and the Bible, they'll go along with that, because who would disagree with that? And they'll allow themselves to be stirred up against Jesus. And if they hear people saying, "Why can God allow suffering?" then that will become their excuse forever. Not everyone who feels that is an excuse. Please don't misunderstand me. But there are many who just trot out these simple excuses and just to please the crowd. They go along with what others are saying. They never think for themselves. And just like the ruler and just like the priest, they're guilty. The priest refused to recognize the Messiah. The ruler refuses to take responsibility. The crowd refuses to release the innocents. Fourthly, the soldiers refuse to take Christ seriously. And as we get to verse 16 through to verse 20, we find that the soldiers, the whole garrison, maybe as many as 600 men, come together and they join in this mockery of Jesus Christ. They pretend to worship somebody. They set him up as their king. And they're violently opposed to him. They have this terrible whip that they bring against him. They scourge him, verse 15. Leather thongs plaited with pieces of bone or lead or bronze woven into the thongs, sometimes hooks. Sometimes such a beating was fatal. But that's what's meted out with Jesus. And this man who has borne so much and will bear even more in the chapters to come. They clothe him, verse 17, with purple. They twist a crown of his thorns. They put it on their head and they begin to salute him. Hail, King of the Jews. They refuse to take Christ seriously. And like the crowd and the ruler and the priest, they are guilty. They are guilty. And maybe they simply cannot understand how this man can claim to be a king when he's got no army and it seems no power. But that's precisely the point that they've missed. That Jesus is a king like no other king. What other king puts himself last? What other king takes the role of a slave? What other king willingly suffers death on behalf of his people? There is no king like Jesus. But because Jesus didn't fit into their box of what a king should be, of a brave soldier taking his troops into battle, who will take difficulty from anyone and will carry his sword at all times and will order others around and will demand but never give, because Jesus never fitted into their expectations of a king, they simply mocked him. And I too know many soldiers, and maybe you do too. I know many men and women, perhaps even boys and girls, for whom Jesus doesn't fit comfortably in their expectations of what they want from a God. And they want somebody who will look at them and smile on them from above and give them nice things from time to time and keep them safe. And they refuse to take him seriously. They end up mocking him. They use his name in vain. They speak evil of him. And in a way that maybe they don't even understand, they're opposed to him in their speech and even in their actions. They refuse to take him seriously. Fifthly, we've seen the priests who refuse to recognize the Messiah, the ruler who refuses to take responsibility, the crowd who refuse to release the innocent, the soldiers who refuse to take Christ seriously. Fifthly, we see the innocent one who refuses to defend himself. The innocent one who refuses to defend himself. Have you noticed in this passage that Jesus is almost passive? Everything describes what happens to Jesus, not what Jesus does. It's the exact opposite of everything that's gone before in Mark. All of Mark's gospel is about what Jesus does, and we follow Jesus round, and he's healing people, he's teaching, he's speaking to the disciples, he's praying, he's doing things all the time, and we get to chapter 15 and he's passive. He does very little. It's not that he's powerless. It's that he chooses not to exercise his power. He goes willingly into whatever is before him. He's the innocent one who refuses to defend himself. And of course, all this is in fulfillment of exactly what the Old Testament would say. 700 years before Jesus was even born, the prophet Isaiah said that he is despised and rejected by men. A man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we did not esteem him. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement for our peace was upon him. By his stripes we are healed. We all like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted. Yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. You see, Jesus fulfilled exactly what was expected of him. If only people had listened, if only people had understood what the Bible taught, that this is exactly the Messiah that was promised of. And Jesus fulfilled not just Isaiah chapter 53, but countless, dozens, perhaps hundreds of Old Testament prophecies about him. He fulfilled them all. He did all that God his Father had asked him to do. He's the innocent one who refuses to defend himself. And sixthly and finally, as we continue these thoughts, we see not just the priests who refuse to recognize the Messiah, not just the ruler who refuses to take responsibility, or the crowd who refuses to release the innocent, or the soldiers who refuse to take Christ seriously. The innocent one who refuses to defend himself. But we see the guilty one who goes free. We see the guilty one who goes free. You see, in the midst of this story is this man called Barabbas. We've glanced at him briefly. He's a murderer. He's a rebel. And the crowd chooses to set Barabbas free and condemn Jesus to death. The guilty one goes free and the innocent is punished in his place. You see, everybody has abandoned and rejected Jesus. As we saw at the beginning, the disciples have left him. Pilate is opposed to him. The Sanhedrin is opposed to him. The crowd are opposed to him. The soldiers are opposed to Jesus. Everybody has rejected and abandoned Jesus. The Jews and the Romans together, all are guilty. And as we've gone through this story and looked at the various characters in the story, we've said that we know many people like that. And maybe it's right that we examine ourselves and we look at these people here and to say, well, who are we in this story? Who are we? Are we Pontius Pilate? Are we the chief priests? Are we the crowd? Are we the soldiers? Who are we? We are everyone. We are everyone. We are the priests who fail to recognize Jesus as King. We are Pilate who refuse to take responsibility for his actions. We are the crowd who prefer evil over good. We are the soldiers who pretend to worship when we don't really believe. We are Barabbas who deserves to be punished. We are everyone. And we cannot point to these other people and to say, look how terrible their sins are, without also recognizing our own sin and recognizing our own transgressions and recognizing that the things that drove these men to their crimes are the very things that reign in our hearts and the very things that cause us to do equally damnable things. We are guilty in every way. And as the Apostle Peter will say at Pentecost in the book of Acts, as he's preaching to the crowd, men and women, ordinary men and women, just like you and I, as he's preaching to them, Peter will say, God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, both Lord and Christ. We are guilty in every way. But the glory of the gospel message is that Jesus did not come to call the righteous to repentance, but sinners. And therefore the message of the gospel is not merely that we are guilty, but that just like Barabbas we can go free. I've often wondered, how did Barabbas respond to what had happened? What did he do afterwards? Did it have any impact on his behavior and his life? Did he go back to his life of crime? I'm sure if he had have gone back to his life of crime, it would only be a matter of time before he was recaptured and retried and punished. What a tragedy that would be if that's what happened to Barabbas. And equally tragic is the fact that today others behave just like that. Jesus offers them hope. Jesus offers them salvation. Jesus offers them himself. Jesus offers to die in their place. And Jesus' death in the place of Barabbas is just a symbol of how Jesus is willing to die in the place of guilty men and women and boys and girls just like us. And so many today will see the hope that Jesus' death offer, but then carry on just as before and go through unchanged despite the cross, despite the blood of Jesus, despite his sacrifice on behalf of sinners. You see, Mark chapter 15 is a tragic passage. But it's a tragedy not simply because a good man died. But the tragedy is that none could see it. The tragedy is that those involved in the story just went on unchanged. The tragedy is that Jesus' death did them no good, because they rejected him. What of us here this evening? Have we recognized all that Jesus has done? Have we seen him for the King of Kings as he is? Have we bowed the knee and begged for forgiveness? Have we acknowledged our sin and our guilt? Because if we have, then Jesus is the innocent one who refuses to defend himself, and we are the guilty one who goes free. The gospel can be offered to all, but it can be received only by those who trust in Christ and in him alone.